Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Jerry Seinfeld, speaking to New Yorker editor David Remnick, suggested that there are no great comedies on TV these days because everybody's afraid of running afoul of the dread PC police. Here's the money quote that's been making the rounds. Here he is, quote, "It used to be you would go home at the end of the day. Most people would go, oh, Cheers is on. Oh, MASH is on. Oh, Mary Tyler Moore is on. All in the Family is on. You just expected there will be some funny stuff we can watch on TV tonight. Well, guess what? Where is it? This is the result of the extreme left and PC crap, and people worrying so much about offending other people. Now they're going to see stand-up comics because we're not policed by anyone," end quote. But I want to rewind a little bit to earlier in the interview, a little bit further back, in which he describes how the comedians he knows greet each other. Quote, "Regular people need courtesies and respect to converse and socialize with them. You can't say hostile things to them, to their face, but comedians love that," end quote. And it's something I've heard from folks who work in writers' rooms on TV shows, you know, the comedy types. They do sometimes complain about feeling like something has been lost. You know, these places used to be kind of competitively antagonistic, right? But now everybody feels like they have to be kind of careful what they say so HR doesn't get involved. Seinfeld, a little bit later, says this, quote, "When you write a script and it goes into four or five different hands, committees, groups, here's our thoughts about this joke. Well, that's the end of your comedy," end quote. And if you look at the show Seinfeld, if you look at the show that Jerry Seinfeld did for a long time with Larry David, Seinfeld, it's easy to see where this comedy by committee could go wrong or take something out of existence. For instance, consider the two recurring characters who are this gay couple who, in one episode, get very offended when Kramer won't wear an AIDS ribbon. Who doesn't want to wear the ribbon, one of them yells. And the joke here is about pushy slacktivists, whatever, but one could easily imagine such a jab rubbing a comedy consultant the wrong way, killing the idea in the room, resulting in a classic bit being lost forever. It's how you wind up with something like Ted Lasso Season 3, in which a sports team's locker room starts delivering lectures about nude photos and consent and all that stuff. Yes, it wasn't funny, but hey, it made a real point. Now, Seinfeld is conflating two issues here. He's talking about the state of modern comedy, which is bad and, you know, doesn't, and the state of modern TV, and doesn't really kind of grapple with the fact that most of these shows have migrated to streaming, where they exist at all, or to premium cable. But I do tend to agree with him that the desire to avoid offense is crippling some comic impulses. But then again, Alyssa, maybe I'm just an old reactionary crank like Jerry Seinfeld. Are we simply not, quote, with it?
Wait a minute, quote. Can't both be true? Maybe Jerry Seinfeld is right and you're an old reactionary crank. I'm sorry.
I think both of those are true. It's both are possible.
Do either of you watch Abbott Elementary?
Is that a comedy on television? I've never even heard of this.
I tried to. It was not my cup of tea.
Totally fine. So Abbott Elementary, you know, is doing like quite well as sort of a, you know, broadly appealing sitcom that, among other things, like makes an enormous amount of fun of it, the white liberal activist teacher character who, you know, teaches in this predominantly black school in Philly. And it's just like, I would be curious to know what Jerry Seinfeld thinks of that show. It is less caustic than Seinfeld, but the writing is very, very sharp and funny. And, you know, I don't know if he's familiar with It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which has been running for, what, like 20 seasons now?
The show is still on, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Show's great.
And it's both like very funny and much more caustic than anything that Seinfeld, I think, would have been able to do on network television. I imagine that Jerry Seinfeld would not necessarily have found Brooklyn Nine-Nine particularly funny, but that was a show that had a lot of really good jokes and, among other things, like made a lot of hay in its final season out of just making brutal fun of ridiculous police union presidents. And so I think Jerry Seinfeld is both mistaken that there are not popular, long-running television comedies that people watch and like, but I also think he is maybe not giving enough credence to the fact that people have different senses of humor. And I think it's entirely possible that there are shows that are not getting made or shows that are more timid than they should be because someone is anxious about HR. But I think it's also possible to have different senses of humor. And so, you know, maybe Jerry Seinfeld wouldn't like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, wouldn't like Abbott Elementary, wouldn't find, you know, making fun of certain attitudes or views of the world or ways of presenting yourself funny. But other people do find those things funny, and it's possible to make that kind of art. And again, you know, we don't have the full transcript of, I don't have the full transcript of the interview available to me, but it just, he comes across as someone who, it just comes across as sort of a lazy argument to make.
Yeah, look, here's the thing. I think Jerry Seinfeld is funnier than most people in human history have been. I think his work speaks for himself. I think that, you know, I'm willing to listen to a lot of what he has to say about this, and he may even be right. I also agree with you, Alyssa, that I think there is a fair amount of pretty good and occasionally very caustic comedy out there. But it is, I think it is getting a little harder to... little harder to find. And for instance, when I want to push back on one of the examples you gave. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. One of my favorite shows on TV. Gut-busting laugh riot. I love it. But it is also very moralizing in a very specific way, which is that these are all terrible people, right? And there is a sort of moralism in comedy that I think is maybe as much what rubs Seinfeld the wrong way as anything else, right? What the whole point of the show Seinfeld was no lessons. Right. That was like, we're never going to have that moment where everybody holds hands and say they learned something. And I wouldn't say that It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia does that. It doesn't.
Because life is like.
But they are very specifically, you know, the point of the show is that these are awful people. The Good Place. Right. The Good Place was very specifically a moralizing sitcom. It was like it was about teaching people how to live, like almost literally.
But that show is such an aberration. Right. I mean. Or at least it represents the very extreme end of a certain kind of television making, right? I mean, it literally is a show that spends a bunch of time like teaching its characters moral philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And
sure.
So I don't think presenting that as representative. I mean, there are always extremes, there are always polarities, but I don't know that show in particular is representative of the mean of modern comedy either.
No, I think that's probably true. Peter, you are not a comedy watcher. You don't care for comedy. We've discussed this on the show before. What will it take for me to get you to watch Righteous Gemstones, which is one of the funniest shows on TV? I think you would really enjoy it. I think you'd get a kick out of it.
I don't know, man. What would it take to get me to watch that?
What would I have to say to you? How do I get you behind the wheel of a Righteous Gemstones today?
Here's how it's going to have to work. There's going to have to be another pandemic. And the only new show that makes it onto television somehow or another is The Righteous Gemstones.
Wow.
And if and when that happens, it's the only scripted show that runs for a year. I'll probably check it out. And it's the only scripted show that runs for a year and I have nothing else to do.
What if it's full of bad puns, or do you only like making the bad puns, not hearing other people make them?
I like hearing other people make bad puns in real life. But this is the thing, is I work in Washington and read the news all day long. I don't need any more comedy in my life.
Hi-oh.
It's freaking hilarious. I read the front pages of all the major newspapers, and it's... like, there is enough comedy there for me every day. I think the world is bleakly and terribly funny, and I don't feel like I don't need jokes to get me there. I like comedy in conversation, and I like funny people. I don't necessarily, and I even appreciate a certain type of cinematic comedy. I would say there's a whole lot of comedy in the Coen brothers movies that I just love, and that's the kind of comedy that I gravitate toward, which is almost never about setting up or delivering a joke. It's about the fact that people are freaking strange. They are irreducibly strange. And when you put two irreducibly strange people in the same room, or three or five, as the Coen brothers often do, and just let them do their weird things and kind of bounce off of each other and clash in whatever weird ways, then you get, that is the best comedy to me. And so, you know, Fargo is kind of a thriller or whatever, but like, I watch Fargo and I like bust up. That is a movie that kills me with laughter. Because that's the kind of thing that I find funny. A movie like Burn After Reading, which is a lot more overtly comic, I think, even than Fargo. Though Fargo is very clearly, intended to be funny, but it's like, to me, I think it's even funnier than most people sort of see. It's like every scene is comic gold. I find myself in fits and stitches. And so I think a lot of television comedy is about sort of building and structuring jokes. And I appreciate that as an art form very much. And in fact, as I've gotten older, I have come to appreciate, in particular, stand-up comedy sort of as a, not as something that I engage with very much, but as something that I understand that there's a form there that the pros study, and that like I'm just interested in it that way. So all of that aside, like you're right to introduce me as the guy who doesn't watch television comedy. What do I have to say about this? I have two things to say. You read this whole long quote, and I think there are two bits that are worth focusing on. And the first one is when he talks, when Jerry Seinfeld says, people used to come home and they used to watch, and he gives a list of shows. They're all quite a bit shows from the, I don't think any of those shows aired after 1985. They're all quite a bit older. And all of them are network television shows. And so part of his complaint, as I read it, again, this is a casual conversation. He doesn't elaborate here, but like part of his complaint as I read it is not just that there's no good comedy, but there's no unifying comedy. He is clearly nostalgic for the days when there were just a couple of networks and the big comedies were really, really big. It wasn't quite that everyone watched them, but everyone, to a first approximation, had most American adults in workplaces had some sort of connection to those big, successful, long-running comedies. And that is just no longer true. And I think that that nostalgia is part of what is driving his complaint here. But the other thing is, he complains about, you talked about the committee, but he talks about, oh, you hand it off to four or five groups, whatever. We don't know exactly what he's referring to here. Maybe it's just getting passed around studio executives, but that's always been the case. Everything that gets written in Hollywood for all of our lifetimes, for the last 40-something years, has been noted and noted and noted, right? Like there are readers who say, well, do it this way or do it that way. And some writers respond and some writers don't. And that's just kind of always been true. And there are always these sort of different imperatives for what any given piece of writing, any script, whether it's a comedy or a drama in Hollywood, should be. I think my sense is that what he is talking about is something like sensitivity readers. And we know that there are sensitivity readers in the publishing industry. There's been quite a bit of reporting about this. And it's not just one little group that's reviewing a couple of YA books. It has gone much further than that. I can't imagine that there's not some sort of similar mechanism in Hollywood that has popped up over the last decade or so. I'm not saying that I know exactly what it is or exactly how it works inside a big studio or inside Netflix or any of these kind of publisher companies that are running this stuff. But it seems like he is complaining about essentially reads for PC. Are you on the right side of history with this joke, Jerry? Right? And that sort of thing. And comedy is, especially Jerry Seinfeld's style of comedy, which even as a non-comedy person I'm familiar enough with, I think, to characterize, comedy is incredibly specific. And it's delicate and precise. And the people who are good at it, their brains are kind of, they are just wired to balance this stuff in a really careful way. And then they test it also with audiences. And this is part of what he talks about later. Beyond that is that the referees shouldn't be the sensitivity readers. The referees shouldn't be the committees. They should be the audiences. And a good comic stays on the right side of history, but not by listening to the people who try to preempt you and say, your joke is bad before you even tell it, but instead by listening to the audience. And you know what? If the audience laughs, it's a good joke. And I think that's Jerry Seinfeld's position here. Again, he doesn't elaborate it, but that seems to me like where, you know, sort of where he's coming from. And he's nostalgic for a world in which there were huge hit comedies that everyone knew about, and partly he's nostalgic for a world in which the audience was the referee rather than the sensitivity readers who are saying, oh, you can't be mean to this group or that group or say this word or that word that way because, you know, that might be problematic.
Yeah, one thing I would just add to that is it's possible that the audience changes over time too, right? And that's, I think, one of the things that is hard about making popular entertainment is that tastes change over time. And, you know, sometimes the thing that you made, the business model gets blown up and it's no longer possible to do it in the same way. Sometimes, you know, the audience's values and ideas change and the referee rules you out. And I think that's it. I think it's a hard business to be in. But I also think that, you know, Jerry Seinfeld could be smarter and more nuanced when he talks about these things.
I think it's a fair complaint to want the audience to be the referee rather than somebody else. I will say, though, on that, and it's, you're totally right, Alyssa, the audience does change over time. And I think it's pretty clear that it, to some degree or another, the audience has changed over the last decade. But I also just have this very strong sense that the counterculture, the sort of, I don't know if I would call it youth, but younger person counterculture of today is moving back, not back towards 90s raunch comedy in its, you know, grossest form, but moving away from comedy that is scared to break PC shibboleths, you know, heavily influenced by them. And in fact, comes out of a world where that is the stuff that you can't say, and that there is, you know, I just think that the people who are a little younger than us, who are kind of grumpy dissident types, are very much going to be producing stuff that is less bound by and less concerned by what's the sensitivity readers of the world have to say about things.
All right. So what do we think? Is the modern state of comedy a controversy or a non-troversy? Alyssa?
I think it's probably a non-troversy.
Peter?
It's a little bit of a controversy, though the fact that Jerry Seinfeld is saying this is maybe not a controversy.
I think it's a controversy. I think we gotta get rid of that extreme left. Get him out of there. Get him out of the comedy rooms. We got Seinfeld. You're right. All right. Make sure to swing by Bowler Plus on Friday for our bonus episode about the cinematic scores of Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, an unlikely duo who have become the most important film composers of the last two decades or so, and whose work on Challengers is getting tons of praise. Speaking of which, on to the main event. Challengers, directed by Luca Guadagnino. I enjoy cheekily referring to this movie as the quote-unquote tennis threesome movie, but it's a pretty solid shorthand, really. Mike Feist plays Art Donaldson. He's an aging pro hoping to complete the career slam that's winning all four of the majors by winning the U.S. Open after coming back from surgery. He and his wife slash coach slash business manager, Toshi Donaldson, who's played by Zendaya, they think he has at least one more run left in him, and to get him back into the right mental space, she has booked him to play in a low-level Challenger Tour event. Basically, it's like the minor leagues of the ATP Tour. Also at this event is Patrick Zweig, who's played by Josh O'Connor. He's living in his car and strongly considers tanking in the first round just so he can collect the check he needs to move on to the next spot. Patrick and Art and Toshi have a history, and the film hops back and forth between time to show us that history and how their evolving relationship relates to their own desires to win and excel at tennis and with each other. Patrick and Art were doubles partners, winning the junior doubles championship at the U.S. Open for squaring off in the singles tournament. They meet Toshi at a party. After tricking the two boys into making out, Toshi tells them whoever wins their match, their finals match, will get her number. Patrick wins, gets the number, and they start dating while Art and Toshi go to Stanford together. She is a phenomenon, but she is delaying her entry into the pros so as to get her education, because, you know, hitting a ball with a racket isn't the only thing in life, and you can only do it for a short period of time. Patrick's playing in the minors in these challenger type events and kind of complaining about it. She wants him to take his game seriously. He tells her to stop talking about tennis. She tells him she's always talking about tennis, and they blow up. They have a big fight. But that's the difference between the two of them, and frankly, her and her future husband, Art. Her mind is set on greatness. And if she thinks she cannot achieve greatness herself on the court, thanks to a horrible knee injury she suffers, she will achieve greatness as part of a duo. It turns out Art is better suited for that role than Patrick, but Art is getting ready to hang it up. He wants to be a husband and a father. The very idea of that sort of domestic tranquility is, I think, off-putting, to put it lightly, to Toshi. She doesn't want to spend her days with Art in a living room reading novels. She doesn't want to watch him doing TV hits on the Tennis Network. You know, she wants him to win. Win what? Win everything. Challengers is a movie about desire, first and foremost. Sexual, yes. The stated desire the young men have for this insanely attractive tennis player. The unstated desire that they have for each other as longtime friends and partners. But desire really in all its forms, right? Tashi desires greatness, immortality, is looking for a means to achieve it. It's why she delays entering the pro game. Art desires Tashi's love and respect. It's why he keeps playing, even though he clearly wants to hang it up following his injury. And Patrick desires being able to play the game as long as he can until he has to quit and go work for his family doing something. If he can kind of stick it to Art a little in the process, well, that's just a nice bonus. One thing this movie captures is the mental nature of tennis and how physical skills are only part of the picture, right? Like, at any given time, there are probably 200 guys in the world who could be the best tennis player in the world. And what separates the five best from the rest of everybody else is what's in between the ears. It's what's it's who has the desire to win, the ability to focus on that desire to the exclusion of everything else, and the ability to kind of mix fear and hope and focus all at the same time, right? When Tashi tells Art she's going to leave him if she loses to Patrick, it's precisely the sort of motivation he needs. The fear of losing is almost as important as the desire to win. I enjoyed Challengers a lot. It's very funny. It's about adult relationships, right? It's one of those mythical movies for adults. It's about the sport I probably know best from playing, though I have some issues with it. And, like, honestly, my biggest complaint is about the score that everybody keeps talking about and praising. Lots of people have declared it to be excellent. I found it just kind of distracting and a little bit annoying. It's like the director was afraid people would find tennis boring, so he asked Reznor and Ross to throw in some Euro trash house dub or whatever you call this particular brand of techno noise. I frequently like techno noise in my music, right? I love the score for the Neon Demon, one of my favorites, but here it really felt like a crutch. Peter, I swear I'm not saying this just to annoy you, because I know you love the score, but it was a little bit much, wasn't it?
No, it was exactly the right amount of much. This movie is funny. Just funny. It's not just a, right, and it's not a comedy in the traditional sense, but this movie is funny. And it's funny not exactly in the way I was describing with the Coen brothers earlier, but in a different way that really appeals to me, which is this movie is cinematically funny. There are just so many funny cuts in this film, funny shots, juxtapositions that you wouldn't get just by sort of reading what the action is doing on the page, sort of a kind of description of it. It's funny because of the precise way that that the director captures this stuff, sort of juxtaposes the images and sort of moves the camera, and also because of the way the score interacts with the editing and the shot choices. And there are so many musical jokes in this movie that just, like, they're kind of thrilling at times, but they're also, like, I just, like, sort of, like, threw myself back in the chair when I was watching this and thought, right? I just, like, it's so great and so fun and so amusing in the way that it uses the score, and it's totally over the top. Yes,
I'm sorry, can I interrupt just briefly to ask you to explain what one of those musical jokes is? You say this, but I'm not entirely sure I understand.
Okay,
what
you mean. The very beginning of the movie, the first time we hear the Trent Reznor Atticus Ross score really kick in, is the moment when the tennis match at Phil's Tire. Or whatever the hell it is that they're playing at this, like, super low-rent tennis tournament, you know, Journey to the Masters thing is. We see the two guys lined up, and then the camera just ridiculously, ostentatiously zooms from, like, way the hell back all the way across the tennis court, right down the line, right down the net, and we see Tashi just sitting there in the middle, and it's this perfect, beautiful little joke about the way that she's caught in between them inside a tennis game, and that's what the whole f-ing movie is about, and it's just, like, I just watched that, and I was like, okay, I get it. Every single shot, every single cut, and as this happens, the music just kicks in, and it's ridiculously over the top. It's this, like, it is basically what you said. It's heavily influenced by European house music, and then similarly just by, like, big EDM party music. And you just, and a lot of that stuff is sort of super upbeat, big drops, but also about bodies grinding up against each other. Yeah, and that is what the music is doing. Even when those guys are separated by a net, the music is grinding their bodies together in the score, and the visuals are then giving you the love triangle and like giving you it's not even a metaphor. It's just this sort of perfect visual capturing of the dynamic between them all the time in the movie in a way that just cracked me up.
I thought the music functioned as a way, like the music is hormonal rushes in the movie, right? It is a way of physicalizing for the audience what the characters are feeling internally. And so it is really over the top and dramatic and comes in like incredibly strong. There's not like a, you know, I mean, these characters are literally just like having blood rushes all the time. And so it's a way of making you feel how overwhelmed they are physically by each other.
And yet it's also incredibly precise, super rhythmic, right? Like just sort of intense, like the beat, right? The music doesn't bounce around like zanily. What the music does is it's hyper-focused because that's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, is those guys, like they like really dig into a groove, but also their music has very deep layers of sound. Trent Reznor, you know, going back to Atticus Ross is now officially part of Nine Inch Nails and has been for several years. But Reznor's music going back to the late 1980s when Nine Inch Nails was founded has always just been super sonically dense. And if you listen on good speakers or good headphones, you will just hear little tiny sounds hiding in the background, just deep, deep layers of these things, right? Because he's so obsessive and so focused about this stuff. And often his music will sort of move from soundscapes to big grooves. We can talk more about this on the bonus episode later, but it just encapsulates so much of what is going on with the characters, as well as adding a sort of not even quite ironic, but a winking grace note to many of the movie's visual flourishes. And that is a lot of what I loved about this movie, is that it takes a topic, a subject, a story that could be pretty dry. Like, honestly, I don't love sports movies like as a genre. I think some of them are good, some of them are bad, but you can imagine a much more prosaic version of this same story. Oh, it's a tennis love triangle, and it kind of gestures at the ways that, you know, tennis, it's kind of like sex, you know, but like, this movie starts from the understanding that you can make a boring version of this. It's like, we are absolutely not going to do this. And at every single moment amps up there's just so much energy in this. And so much, it's so lively in the way that it is directed and staged and framed. And then of course you have three great performances in the middle of this, in which you have, as I wrote in my review, you know, we've had this, and I've said on this podcast, there's a writer who wrote a piece a couple of years ago about the changes in Hollywood bodies and how people have gotten, you know, men in particular, but women as well, have reshaped themselves to look like superheroes. And everyone has just become ridiculously beautiful over the last 10 years. But Hollywood has existed in this world where, you know, everyone is beautiful and no one is horny. And what you get in this movie is a movie in which everyone is beautiful and also really, really horny. And it's kind of great to see that level of desire, that level of wanting portrayed on screen, because that's something that has been missing.
Alyssa, Peter raises a good point that this is a fairly horny movie, as we've discussed, has been lacking from movies. I'm asking this slightly tongue-in-cheek, but not really. I mean, is the male gaze back? This movie is different because it's directed by a gay European man, so it's like a slightly different, but this is very much a movie in which a guy is looking at bodies and being like, I like how all these look.
Yeah, I actually laughed in the theater when our two male main characters like go to Tashi's match. And you just, like, the camera's just, like, following the line of her skirt around. And it's just, like, this is so audacious. I just kind of loved it, right? And I think that it doesn't feel offensive in this movie because it is so, both, like, it expresses the total teenageness of Art and Phil, right? Like, they are, like, these are hormonal teenage guys. And like, that's abundantly clear from the camera work as well as the performances, but also because it's so lusty about the guys themselves, right? It's like Tashi's desire and consumption of the two men in her life is just as important as their sort of desire to consume her. And, you know, I think that that's what's missing from a lot of, you know, from earlier generations of like horny cinema, right? It's like, but it's also one of the reasons that like Patrick Swayze was sort of an incredibly important star in an earlier era when the male gaze kind of dominated so much of cinema. We talked about Roadhouse and the sort of sheer amount of nudity in that original movie a couple weeks ago on the podcast.
But it was, you know, Dirty Dancing where Patrick Swayze became a sex symbol. And that movie notably also was directed by a man who, I don't know if he was out when he made the movie, but he came out later eventually.
Yeah. But so, you know, someone like Swayze, even in an era when, you know, the sort of the male gaze is ascendant, like the camera just loved him so much, no matter who was directing him, that he kind of like, you know, he kind of broke that. He became available for the female gaze. And so a movie like this is so sort of equal. It's so broadly distributed in its lust that it didn't feel off-putting to me in any way. And in fact, that just like the audacity and the sort of pleasure of it was just really enjoyable throughout. I mean, this is a movie that reminds me a lot of Bull Durham, which I think has to have been an influence on it.
Okay. Say more about that.
More about that?
Yeah, well, that's what I want to hear about.
Okay. I mean, so Bull Durham is one of my favorite movies. As longtime listeners to this podcast probably know, I haven't had an opportunity to talk about it in a while. But that is also a movie that is very much about the sort of nature of a sport as expressed through the relationship of one woman to two men. So in Bull Durham, Susan Sarandon plays Annie Savoy, this, you know, sort of super fan for the Durham Bulls, like a local minor league team. And she picks a player every season and has a relationship with him and sort of offers him both her kind of like her life wisdom, but also makes him a better player, right? And it's like getting chosen by her is a big deal on the team. And one season, she ends up with sort of two prospects. Nuke LaLoosh, played by Tim Robbins, who is this, you know, just rookie who has incredible potential, but is just a complete idiot. And Crash Davis, played by Kevin Costner, who is, made the majors briefly and has been sort of a career minor leaguer ever since. And Crash has been brought in to be Nuke's catcher. So you have like the explicit like pitchers and catchers, you know, kind of sexual vibe of the movie and sort of get him ready for the majors. And Annie, to her surprise, like Crash turns her down. He's like, I am not interested in being a part of this dynamic. Until, of course, Nuke makes the majors and then the two of them get together and kind of break out of the dynamic that she's been in. And, you know, both of them are, I mean, there's more and more explicit sex in Bull Durham than there is in Challengers. But it's the same vibe about how, you know, a sport is sort of the expression of all truth, right? There's this famous monologue at the beginning of Bull Durham where Annie says, I believe in the Church of Baseball. I've tried all the major religions, most of the minor ones. I've worshipped Buddha, Allah, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, trees, mushrooms, and Isadora Duncan. I know things. For instance, there are 108 beads in a Catholic rosary, and there are 108 stitches in a baseball. When I learned that, I gave Jesus a chance, but it just didn't work out with us. The Lord laid too much guilt on me. I prefer metaphysics to theology. You see, there's no guilt in baseball, and it's never boring. Which makes it like sex. And so, again, the whole movie is, you know, and Bull Durham is not as good a sports movie per se as Challengers is in terms of expressing like what makes a player good. It's much like it's a certain amount of hokum and like silly comedy. It is a movie written with much more explicit jokes, but it is sort of like it is like adult and lusty and funny and attuned to that, like, the difference between people who make it and people who don't. And I, as a result, it's just like, I really enjoyed it. I think Challengers is a hoot. I really like Mike Faced in this. And I don't think either of you watched the seasons of The Crown where Josh O'Connor plays Prince Charles. Yeah. Oh, did you? Okay. But he's like, he's just a hoot in this, especially if you've seen him playing this like incredibly uptight, you know, iron shoelaces, like character. you know, in Netflix, like on The Crown, and playing this just like complete dirtbag here in a way that's a lot of fun. I just like, I think the movie is just, it's a hoot, right? It's like eating a really good ice cream sundae. And it's a little bit ridiculous, but I actually think that that is what makes it so enjoyable, is its willingness to just own that total absurdity in a very similar way to how Bull Durham kind of owns its, you know, the absurdity of its premise. And they're both movies that absolutely don't work without the three lead performances, right? Like, you know, I don't know who you replace Zendaya with as Tashi. You know, I can't think of another young actress with that same kind of imperiousness. And yeah, I think Mike Faist is just freaking great. I mean, he was probably the best part of Steven Spielberg's remake of West Side Story. I think he's just marvelous in this as someone who has just, you know, got everything he wanted and is still just kind of really wounded.
It's interesting because he hasn't gotten everything he wanted. What he actually wants is the love and affection and loyalty of Tashi. You said something.
Guess you better play better.
You said, Alyssa, something along the lines of, you know, the camera is interested in showing her desire for the two men. Yeah. And I don't think that's actually right. I don't think she demonstrates desire for them outside of anything other than a means to an end, trying to get something else. Because she uses her sexuality frequently to get them to do things, to get them to perform in certain ways. When there's a moment about midway through the movie where we see Tashi, the moment when Tashi and Patrick are together in her dorm room, and she is kind of on top of him and making out, and she's like trying to talk to him about tennis, and he's just like, I just wanna bang, come on. And she like rolls off and is like, I'm done with it. If you're not gonna take this seriously, I'm out of here. And I the whole movie is kind of like that. It's all about her. I described her as Lady Macbeth in my review. There is a very strong kind of manipulative edge to her, which I find fascinating. The character she reminds me the most of, and I didn't put this in my review, even though I kind of wanted to, because I didn't want to get yelled at, but I'll do it here. People can yell at me here. The character she reminded me the most of in a very real way is Catherine Trammell from Basic Instinct. She is doing things to get what she wants, and what she wants, I don't think, is them. She wants to see how much she can control them. There's a reason that first scene with all of them in the room together, she backs away and lets them make out together, because she wants to see that she can do it, and she can.
That moment was reportedly not in the original script, by the way. That came out of improvisation on the set, as I understand it. I think that that is partially right, Sonny, but I also think that you are slightly overstating. The movie is somewhat ambiguous about this, because what she wants is control, yes, but what she also wants is success to come from that. And that is what turns her on also. And which is, so there are all of these things are sort of, the movie's point is that these things are not different strand. They're all the same strand of the same thing. They are all exactly the same. Wanting that power over them, wanting success on the court herself, and then eventually as a coach, and wanting those guys, it's all wanting. And this is the thing. It's all wanting, and all wanting
desire.
Is the same, right?
And it's all desire.
This is the movie's key insight, is that you can't separate these types of wanting, and that desire is a mixed drink, right? It's many parts, and you can't, you know, you can't pull it apart. You can't treat these as individual things, because it's all, sure, she just wants to control them in some sense, but like, she's turned on by that. There is a sexual charge. She just wants to be great on the court, but there is a kind of, it is similar to a sexual charge. And when these guys are playing each other, right, she clearly gets a kind of a charge that goes beyond just sort of, I can control these guys. There's something a little bit tingly thrilling about that to her, right? And the final moment in this film, spoilers, is when these guys sort of collapse into a like a cuddle pile over the net, right? A giant man hug thing. And she's like, come on! But there's also, you see very, very briefly, there's a smile. She got them together, and that was something that, like, she kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting movie about characters with sort of incomplete self-control and incomplete self-knowledge, right? Because Tashi is someone who, like, her self-control failed her in this fundamental way, right? Like, her body overrode her ability to will things to happen, right? I mean, her knee did not recover, right? She's that very funny line where she was like, I would have stabbed somebody to have your recovery, like an old person, like a baby, right? But she didn't have that option, right? There she came up against something that just like she couldn't control. And I do think the music symbols with those like big hormonal rushes that like certainly the time that she slept with Patrick when she was engaged, like I don't know that she had perfect self-control in that moment. Like, I don't, you know, I think she is kind of carried away. And, you know, I think both of the guys, like, you know, we learn that Patrick has been sort of faking poverty, right? Like, he's from, like, an incredibly wealthy family that he could go home to, but he's kind of slumming it, right? And he has not sort of integrated these parts of his personality. Like, you know, the scene where he's on this, like, awful Tinder date just because he needs a place to stay is hilarious. And, like, really pathetic. and yet, like, you know, he lands the date. He lands the place to stay, even though he's behaving in, like, an objectively awful way. And, you know, Art, in a way, is the one of them who's come kind of, like, the closest to self-knowledge, right? Like, he knows that he wants to be done. He, I think, like, kind of knows what his dynamic with Tashi is. But he is the person who's, like, not mentally been able to kind of like make the scenario workable. I don't know. I thought it was, I mean, I think I appreciate that the movie manages to be pretty tough on its characters in some ways, while also being like lusty and fun and great to look at.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely enjoyed, I enjoyed all these dynamics because they do feel real and also they're less straightforward than you would sometimes expect from a movie like this. I mean, the most interesting shot in the movie to me is the one where Tashi comes home back to their hotel room and sees her husband like laying in their daughter's bedroom. And like it's this like it's this shot of domestic tranquility that usually inspires like an awe moment. And she and it like I got the sense that it like actively annoyed her. Which again is just a, which is just like a thing you don't often see in a movie like this.
Yeah, well, but also that she's sort of irritated because in the scene before she'd been like, you know, Art had asked her if she would hold him until he fell asleep, and she sort of thought she had like done that. She goes and sneaks off and meets up with and has sex with Patrick, and she comes back and she's like, okay, clearly got up at some point during the night. Like she's irritated that, like, her plans, once again, have not quite worked out.
One thing before we go, what do we make of the fact that Justin Kuritsky's, the screenwriter, is married to Celine Song, who did Past Lives last year, and was also a movie about a sort of a three-way relationship with a woman at the center picking between these two types of men, where it is very, like,
And she's writing another movie about a complicated three-way relationship between like a matchmaker and her clients, right? It's like
I'm very excited for this future universe of three-part, you know, triangular relationship movies.
My only real thought on this is that I like this movie much more than Past Lives. I think it's much better. But I'm probably in the minority on that one. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Challengers, Alyssa?
Thumbs up. Super fun.
Peter.
Thumbs up, and the score is fantastic. Even on its own, strongly recommend if you got a streaming service. Just pump it up, listen on good speakers.
Thumbs up, though the score does insist upon itself in ways that are very annoying. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks for our audio engineer, Jonathan Siri, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.